This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending 2005 by featuring a week of our favorite interviews of the year. This year, Philip Roth became the third living author to have his or her collected works published by the Library of America, which is dedicated to keeping in print the best American writing. The first two Roth volumes of his projected 8-volume series were published in September. They span the years 1959 to 72 and include the books that made him famous, Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. You can't accuse Roth of resting on his laurels. His latest novel, The Plot Against America, is a bestseller. I spoke to Roth about the Library of America editions, but he declined to do a reading. He's happy to talk about his early work. He just doesn't want to reread it. A heads up to parents of young children, during this interview, Roth talks about how he approached the subject of sex in Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint. Let's start with your first book, Goodbye Columbus, published in 1959. Now, the novella in this book, it's like a novella and short stories, the novella in this book has so much to do with class. You know, the main character comes from a very working class family in Newark, and he falls in love with a suburban girl, a Jewish girl, who seems to be from another world because, you know, she plays tennis, she wears cashmere sweaters. And it's a world that I think in some ways seems less intellectual, more materialistic and shallow, but it's still so attractive to him. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about what encountering that class meant to you when you were young?
Well, I think...
Because you came, like your character, from working class Newark.
Yeah, that's right. Not from the fancy suburbs. I think when you're young, a class comes as a great surprise. Most people, I guess, begin to run into it as a surprise when they go to college, because in grade school and high school, you're usually with boys and girls who are from your own background. But when you go to college, there's a mix, and you meet people who are either poorer than you were or richer than you were. And I think one is very sensitive to that as a young person, someone between, say, 17 and 22 or 23. So, I was not unusual in that respect. I too, was stunned by wealth, or what seemed to me to be wealth, and the differences between the way the wealthy lived, or the privileged lived, and the way we had lived. Not that I ever thought of my own background as poor. I think we were, actually, but I never experienced it that way. The house had everything I ever wanted, and the neighborhood was more or less homogeneous. But I think classes comes as a great shock, yes.
Perhaps the most talked about scenes from Goodbye Columbus have to do with the diaphragm. There's a scene in which the main character convinces his girlfriend to buy a diaphragm, and she says, why do we need it? You know, we're careful. And he says, for pleasure, and it becomes clear he's talking about for his pleasure, because, you know, he'd prefer to use that instead of a condom. And they argue about this a little bit, but they finally, agree mm-hmm. to go to the Margaret Sanger Clinic, which she's heard about through reading Mary McCarthy books.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems very groundbreaking at this time to write about a sexual relationship in this kind of candid way, to actually address that birth control exists and that there are different kinds of birth control methods and that there are relative merits and disadvantages of each one. Did you feel like this was, you know, outside of Mary McCarthy, entering mm-hmm. new territory?
It just seemed to me to be what was. That this is all takes place before Roe v. Wade, you know? There was no legalized abortion. Young men and young women were extremely concerned with the young woman not getting pregnant, because there was no recourse. Recourse generally in those years was marriage, especially between middle-class kids. So it was a crucial issue, because there was no remedy short of something drastic, which was either marriage for very young people or an illegal abortion, which was quite terrifying, if one even knew how to go about doing it. Therefore, there's a certain weight to that discussion that probably the book doesn't have any longer for contemporary young people. But at the time, it was truly a monumental subject that arose between a young man and a young woman.
Well, also one of the first things she's asked when she calls the clinic is she married? I mean, it was a really big step for a young woman then who was not married to go to a clinic and admit that she was having sex.
Absolutely. It may seem like a small thing now, but it really wasn't a small thing for Brenda, coming from her background, to do. It wasn't a small thing for him to ask her to do. It wasn't a huge thing, but there's a ripple on the surface there. Of course, they're undone by that because, as I remember, correct me, Terry, you read this.
Okay.
I haven't.
Go ahead.
I'll try.
I'll grade you on your accuracy about your own book.
Well, if I had written the book, I would have the diaphragm discovered by the mother, who, because between the mother and the daughter in that book, there's a certain amount of hostility, ordinary sort of hostility between mother and daughter at that age. But the mother, I believe it's the mother, finds the diaphragm. And this precedes the sort of argument that ends their affair. And Brenda feels that she can't, having been revealed, having had her true sexual nature revealed to her family, she becomes timid, or you might say she becomes sensible. I don't know. I don't interpret it myself. And she says to him, we can't go on with this. And they don't. So the diaphragm isn't introduced in the story just to have the requisite diaphragm in the story. But the story turns on that decision and is resolved because of that decision.
Let's move on to Portnoy's Complaint, which is a book that so defined you. In the first part of your career, it was published in, was it 1969?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 1969.
And the book is a novel, but it reads almost more like a really long riff on the subject of a young man breaking away from an overprotective mother and an kind of ineffectual father, and becoming. You know, it was very absorbed, if not obsessed, with his own sexuality. That's kind of generalizing much too much and over-reducing.
No, I would just add, Terry, that it's told in the form of a monologue delivered to a psychoanalyst. And since sex is a central subject in psychoanalysis, that's why they're talking about it. He's not in a bar or in a classroom. So that's very important where it takes place and to whom he's speaking.
I know you don't want me to read from your book, but allow me to just read a couple of lines from his monologue to his psychiatrist. Look, am I exaggerating to think it's practically miraculous that I'm ambulatory? The hysteria and the superstition, the watch-its and the be-carefuls. You mustn't do this. You can't do that. Hold it. Don't. You're breaking an important law. What? Whose law? Doctor, these people are incredible. These people are unbelievable. These two, he's talking about his parents, these two are the outstanding producers and packagers of guilt in our time. They render it for me like fat from a chicken. Call, Alex. Visit, Alex. Alex, keep us informed. Don't go away without telling us, please. Not again. And so on. And he says to his psychiatrist, I can't stand anymore being frightened like this over nothing. Bless me with manhood. Make me brave. Make me strong. Make me whole. Enough being a nice Jewish boy, publicly pleasing my parents while privately pulling my putts. Enough. So what made you want to write it in that voice of, like, basically a long confession and complaint to a psychiatrist?
Well, can I tell you a little bit of the history of how the book was written?
Please.
And I think that'll answer the question. In between 1960 and 1962, I was making a living by teaching in the writer's workshop in Iowa City. And I had among my students some Jewish students, and almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them at one point write a story in which there was an overbearing mother and an ineffectual father and an angry daughter or son, depending upon the sex of the writer. And I saw this thing repeated over and over again, and I thought, I'm face to face with folklore. This is a legend, a true legend perhaps, but the backgrounds of these people, and they were probably people born in 1940, I wasn't much older than they were, the backgrounds of these people all lead them to this legend, and I was impressed by the story. So I began by writing a short story, which I called A Jewish Patient Begins His Analysis. And it was published in Esquire magazine. And what I'm trying to get to is that there was not so much forethought in my writing this book, nor did I know beforehand what the hell I was doing. After I wrote that, I thought, go ahead. You found something there. What had I found? That in talking to the invisible analyst, or at least using that as the conceit, I had opened up my verbal floodgates, you know, that I could go further. Not only that, but that the psychoanalytic session gave me permission to speak freely of sex. I needed an opening that would permit me to write about things I knew about, that I knew I could be interesting about, but how, where was I going to get the permission to do it? Reading Henry Miller gave me a certain kind of permission. He was marvelous, I thought, in the Tropic of Cancer. But aside from that, maybe Lolita in some small way, I didn't know anything in American literature where there was an open representation of the madness, say, of masturbation. It's mad. At any rate, I wrote this story about the character talking to his analyst about masturbating. And nobody wanted to publish that, and except a very unlikely magazine for me for that story, which was a very elite journal called the Partisan Review. And the response to that, which was tremendous, though it was a magazine with a circulation of no more than 2,000, I think, and I think I got $50 for it, that prompted a tremendous response from people around me. People in New York, I was living in New York at this time, who read it. And that was when I was encouraged to go all the way with the book and say, okay, you've got the beginnings. I had to rewrite bits of the first two chapters once they became chapters rather than stories. But this is the way to go. You're free. Well, there's no two words are more precious to a writer. I mean, than you're free.
It's interesting, you know, that it's by heading toward a taboo that you felt you're free. Do you know what I mean? Because what's more taboo? What was more taboo then than writing about masturbation? I mean,
well, I don't think it was the most taboo subject. I think it was writing about masturbation in a domestic Jewish situation.
Right. Taboo. Yeah, and add all that to it. Yeah.
Sure. Because if you think of Henry Miller, the book was banned here for many years, Tropic of Cancer. But there are things far more taboo. There's all trafficking with whores. There's all kinds of stuff. This was, the freedom came not from being a wild man. I was free because I'd found the vessel into which to put this stuff. That is, the vessel was the psychoanalytic session. There was my freedom, because he's trying to solve a problem. And the problem has to do with something larger than masturbation. You didn't think you'd ever hear me say that, did you?
So what is the problem that you see it?
Well, it has to do with brutality, I think. The discovery of one's own brutality. Among those who were shocked and outraged, I think they were shocked and outraged by the revelation of brutality of feeling. I don't necessarily mean physical brutality. There is some of that in the book. Brutality of feeling, brutality of attitude, brutality of anger, the excesses. That you say all this takes place in a Jewish family? That was what was shocking. That was the revelation that was shocking, not masturbation per se.
My guest is Philip Roth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Philip Roth. When we left off, we were talking about his novel, Portnoy's Complaint. This book also became famous because of what it said about Jewish middle-class life or Jewish working-class life. Like, for instance, in writing about his father, he writes, he drank, of course, not whiskey like a goy, but mineral oil and milk of magnesia and chewed on Ex-Lax and ate all bran morning and night. He suffered, did he suffer, from constipation. And the sense of, you know, that, like, his father wasn't, like, macho, like, you know, he didn't drink whiskey, he drank milk of magnesia. That's one of the themes through the book. And the sense of, like, some things are goyish and some things are Jewish. And some of the things that were goyish, not Jewish, seem much more desirable and exotic and romantic and manly and so on. Of course, you took a lot of heat for that, you know, from Jewish critics and Jewish readers who felt, you know, that you were insulting your own Jewishness and other people's too. Were you prepared for that? And was that something that you were concerned about at all in writing it? Or did you just want to, like, get that voice right?
With Portnoy's Complaint, I can't say that I wasn't prepared for something, because it was obviously, and looked at one way, an act of provocation. But I just wrote it out, really. It was very fierce. I was called a lot of disgusting names that were false. I was called a Jew hater. I was called an anti-Semite. I was called a self-hater, and so on. This was offensive to me. Remains, the people who made those comments remain offensive to me. I think I was talking about something that was, which was, this kind of rage existed, this kind of defiance existed, this kind of anguish, by the way. I think one thing that's in the book is that must be noted is the anguish of this character. This comedy is a form of suffering, and otherwise I wouldn't be interested in it. It wasn't just a kind of stand-up routine or anything like that.
Was your mother prepared for it? Because so many people must have assumed that the mother in your book was based on your mother. Mm-hmm. And so many Jewish mothers who didn't even read Portnoy's Complaint were offended by it. How did your mother handle it?
I'm good at offending people who don't read the book. That's probably the strongest thing I do. Well, my mother and father were pretty good. I have to tell you, I had to prepare them. I felt I had to prepare them for the publication of this book. That was not something I had done with the previous three books. But before Portnoy's Complaint, I did have to prepare them, I thought, because it became clear as publication came upon us that it was going to be a big book. And we had lunch, and I said, look, this book is going to come out, and appears as though it's going to cause a sensation because it has the following ingredients in it, and I told them what they were. I said, and you are going to be telephoned by journalists, and you have no experience with that, and I want to prepare you for it. Number one is you don't have to talk to anybody. You can politely hang up or unpolitely hang up. They're just journalists, you know, and they'll be very nice to you, and they'll say flattering things to you, try to get you to talk, but you don't have to. I said, if you want to talk, that's fine with me too. But I want you to know you don't have to, and that you won't give offense to anyone if you don't. And you may be well advised not to, but it's finally up to you.
So did they?
Well, the story is better than that.
yeah?
Yeah. They left the restaurant, And I didn't know this till after my mother died. My father and I were taking a walk. We took many walks after that, and he was telling me lots of things. They got into the taxi cab, and my mother burst into tears. My father said, "What's the matter?" He said, "He has delusions of grandeur." And I've never known him to be like, he's not like that, but he's going to be terribly, terribly disappointed. And my father would say, he knows what he's talking about or whatever. My mother said, "No, I can't bear how hurt he's going to be when this doesn't happen." So that was her reaction. In fact, what happened was that they did get numerous phone calls, and they were polite and didn't say anything. I think my mother said one thing that was quoted by the New York Times. She just found it very difficult to hang up on the New York Times, you know? It's really quite easy. But she didn't know that. And she, in response to the question, the needling question about Jewish mothers and herself, she said, it was worthy of Pascal, really. She said, "All mothers are Jewish mothers." That shut him up. So he was quoted in the New York Times as saying that. And I think there are many Christian mothers around America who may have taken real exception to that.
Philip Roth recorded in September after the publication of the first two volumes of a projected 8-volume collection of his works published by the Library of America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.